All right, gents, are we ready? Good
To go.
Yep. Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Welcome, everybody, to the Long Dormant Renegade HVG podcast. We're coming in with a roundtable for you guys today. Something a little different that I wasn't doing in the past, but was kind of in the mind for a while. And so what we have four highly skilled painters. We have Zach, who's Arc Like Miniatures, Eric, who's Suji, Tommy, who's Love to Pronk, and Kevin, who is Bushido on your screen. And the goal for this conversation is to get these experts together at miniature painting and let them talk with each other. So it's not so much going to be kind of my typical podcast where I'm kind of, you know, talking about history and kind of one-on-one. And I'm really going to try to step out as much from this conversation as possible. And I'll have some questions kind of keep the conversation flowing. But for the most part, I really want to give you guys access to these painters and be kind of a fly on the wall, listening to their conversations with each other, talking about the skills that have kind of advanced them, their own painting, kind of picking each other brains about their weaknesses that somebody else might be strong at, and kind of letting you guys benefit from that conversation. And so with that being said, I'm going to try to take a step back. We're going to do quick intros here for everybody so they can kind of talk a little bit about themselves, talk about, you know, kind of what they like to focus on painting or, you know, their genre before we go. But I don't want to spend an hour kind of doing intros. I really want to kind of dive into the nitty-gritty for you guys. But that being said, I'm going to drop out the video, let these guys go. First, we're going to start with, we'll do Zach first, then Eric, then Tommy, then Kevin. Let's give that quick intro, and then somebody can kind of, you know, throw their hand up to ask that first question of each other. All right, so I'll drop out, and Zach, you're up. Let's give a quick intro and start talking about painting.
Alrighty, so my name is Zach. I run the page Arc Light Miniatures. I've been painting pretty seriously for about five and a half years now. I dabbled a little bit throughout my youth. My old man was a diehard nerd, super into Battletech and 40K growing up, so that was my intro. And once I became an adult and actually had money and time to throw around, I decided to dive headfirst into it when COVID hit, because I had a lot of time on my hands, and here I am.
All right, Eric, you're up.
So my name is Eric, also Sugay. How I got into it. Long story short, worked on cars and did vintage restoration for a long time with my dad and my grandfather. So I kind of retranslated those skills into miniature painting. Was always into Battletech ever since I was a little kid. Prior, reading source books and whatnot, and kind of got into it more seriously about the same time as acting around COVID time. So basically when the Steam game came out. So that's about it.
Awesome. Tommy, you're up.
Hey, cool. Hi, my name is Tommy. I paint at Love to Pronk. You might know me from the Battletech card game miniature series. I love the Battletech card game. Been painting forever. Been painting since, I guess, high school and stuff. So, here I am. Thank you.
Awesome. Kevin, you, bud.
I'm Kevin Witt. I go by Rashido at CSO. I have been painting Battletech since I was 4, and I'm 39. I've been seriously display painting for the last 8 or 9 years, and I'm really kind of into trying to make, like, the best-looking miniatures. So, trying to go for all the big awards and stuff like that, but my dad got me into it when I was 4 and I never looked back. So
awesome. All right, well, let's dive in, gentlemen. We have some questions you guys had for each other. You know, I think we talked a little bit before about the kind of Battletech minis. Obviously, we want to focus on Battletech here, but let's just give a quick start to kind of get the conversation going and kind of a why and how. But tell me kind of your favorite Battletech mini to paint, and kind of your least favorite. And I'm guessing that least favorite might play into the mold lines, which we brought up as a possible conversation starter. So, Zach, what's your favorite Battletech mini to paint?
Any Timberwolf Madcap variant. I'm a simpleton. Madcap Mark II is by far my favorite chassis. I fell in love with it playing the MechWarrior 4 franchise, which is also my favorite MechWarrior franchise. But yeah, the Madcap Mark II, and then the Timberwolf Savage Wolf is pretty good too. It's got a nice aesthetic, but all the Madcap series. And least favorite, Honestly, probably the little bug mechs like wasps, locusts, stuff like that. I like having a bigger canvas to work on, and I like details, and I just find they're kind of small and fiddly.
Tommy, you can take that. His favorite's the Timberwolf. We talk about the Timberwolf a lot with him.
Oh, man. You knew I would have words to say about it. The Timberwolf, the Mad Cat. I've painted so many because it's popular. I mean, it's so iconic, but oh, God, I hate that thing with the mold lines on his leg. I have so much trouble with it. It's been requested the most for me. My favorite's probably the Masakari or the Warhawk. I love that thing. It's a good mech, solid. It's got nice flat panels. It's solidly built. It's easy to clean, work with. Yeah.
Nice. Eric, what's yours, buddy?
I mean, I'm a simp too, man. I mean, I love the Mad Cat, the Timberwolf. I'm not gonna lie. Any variation, man, it doesn't matter. You can ask them in the chat. Like, we do paint trade offs, and they're like, "Hey, what do you want, Eric?" And I'm like, "Yeah, just give me another Timberwolf." A close second, though, is Marauder 2. Marauder 2C, actually. Love that mech as well. So a lot of nice flat panels, a lot of stuff you can do with that. I do lean towards the Heavy and Assault, just because there is more of a canvas to play with versus the little guys, and the mold lines are definitely tougher going on the smaller mechs as well. So
cool. Kevin, what's yours, bud?
My least favorite is the CGL Mad Cat in the plastic one, I love the Mad Cat. It's one of my favorite mechs, but the actual, like, having to paint one, the mold lines on any printing of the CGL Mad Cat have been terrible. I'm really glad Ironwind has a metal one, at least of the A out, so that I don't have to. Yeah, I avoid Mad Cats now because the mold lines are so bad. Not to knock it, but can't do it.
All right, so I think we're unanimous. Hardest to clean, minus to look at, maybe. Well, let's talk about mold lines. You know, so let's talk about kind of. I'll let you guys say who has kind of a good technique that they want to share, or maybe specifically a tool that you found is just, you know, kind of made it so much easier for you.
Yeah, I can jump off with this one. So this is half this trick is a brass brush, like something you'd find in a gun cleaning kit. Just a good brass brush with a lot of bristles. One with a big fat end and one with a smaller end is helpful just to get into some nooks and crannies. But I use just like an Olfa X-Acto blade. I use a fresh blade, and I use the backside of the tip to do all my initial scraping. And then for some weird spots, I will actually just like shave with the sharp part of the blade. I will shave the mold line off. After I go through and do all that, I just go aggressively with the brass brush and scrub back and forth across all the areas where the mold lines were. One of the biggest issues with the Catalyst Game Labs plastics is the material that they're made of. When you do scrape them, you tend to end up with a lot of burrs and stuff left over, and that's always a big complaint for a lot of folks. It just leaves a very rough texture. The brass brush pretty much just removes all of that. It helps to like very gently kind of abrade the surface. So it just kind of like smooths everything out and actually helps give like a good little subtle texture for primer and whatnot to grip to. So that's what I go to. I only started using the brass brush in the last year. Prior to that, I was just painstakingly shaving off all burrs and whatnot. So
shout out to Ryan, like B1B Flyer, because he kind of came up with that initially when the plastics came out. It was huge.
Any tools, other brands, that kind of? Eric?
So I do something very similar as well. So one of these, followed by Procrol, makes a kind of a cool scraper tool. I use this quite a bit as well.
What's the brand again?
It is Proacryl or Proacryl, Monument
Hobbies. It's by Monument Hobbies.
Yeah, okay. It's a scraper. I use that quite a bit. This is the thing that Zach about right here.
That is the exact same brush I have.
I don't know if you can get these in Japan because they don't allow guns in Japan. But
no, they don't. I'm looking up right now. I can get a brass brush, but I don't know. It's pretty big.
And then, but you do have this in Japan, and I finish it off with this.
Oh, interesting.
So this actually, so you're not looking to, it's great for not connecting things together, but it's really good for actually like smoothing out your work once you're, you know, you're done all the scratch marks and the scrapes that you got there.
That's really interesting.
It'll smooth everything out because this is meant to melt plastic, right? Not and to kind of weld plastic together, right? For 40K.
So how do you apply that, Eric? Yeah.
Well, it's got a brush on it. Mm-hmm. I actually got this idea from a dude. I wish I could remember his name. But he had a brief little stint on YouTube. He was from Australia, and I for the life of me, I can't remember his name. Really cool dude. Great videos. And he did some tutorials on it. When I first got started into painting battle tech, he used to scrape just like Zach and Kevin, and then use the Tamiya ultra thin cement to kind of smooth out all that work. It's really good.
Interesting.
But I think it's also, you know, like going with like painting cars, same exact thing. All the prep work is really where it's at. Like you can have a great paint job, but if the prep work is garbage, like you're going to see errors, mm-hmm. right, in your work. So a really good primer is also really good for leveling. I actually use Tamiya. Actually, it may not be Tamiya. It's Mr. Surfacer 1500.
That's pretty rough.
I mean, I love it though for battle tech. I mean, I use this stuff all the time, either in a rattle can or out of an airbrush. And I think Vince Venturello talks about that as well.
Nice.
Pretty sure there's YouTube on that.
I use a set of sanding sticks also that are very narrow. I got them off Amazon. They're on somebody's, one of the miniature YouTubers had it as like one of his Amazon affiliate links. And like I ordered once from Amazon, I got like 8 bags of these things and varying grit, but they're narrow enough to get between arms and legs, and which makes some of the sanding a little easier, and they're great.
I think that's what people have difficulty with, is like getting in those joints, especially since like Hell's Game Labs, you can't really disassemble them. Do any of you like cut them apt and then reassemble them?
I don't personally, but there is somebody that we're familiar with in CSO, and anybody who's in most of the BattleTech communities will probably know him, Josh Bressel. But he does basically full disassemblies for every model. I've talked to him a bit about his process. He puts his miniatures in the freezer, putting it in the freezer will help to make the factory glue brittle. And then he just kind of gently breaks them apart, and he'll cut pieces if he needs to, but he pretty much just tries to brute force disassemble them that way, and it does a pretty good job. He occasionally gets a couple breakages, but he just glues things back together.
Makes sense. We talked about the car process. Eric, you were talking about working with cars. I use a pretty similar process for mold lines for model cars anyway. Pretty fine grit sandpaper. They sell it here to work with model cars, varying grit. But I think the sticks would really help get into those joints and help me apply the force into the nooks and crannies.
Yeah,
a lot better.
They're great, and they have like a foam core, so they're kind of bendable, and you can cut them as like you wear parts of them out. I'll post.
I wonder if I can just make my own. Wrap some sandpaper around.
I use them lately, and I don't. But when we talk about mold lines, though, it's very important that you shave off one mold line and two more shall take its place.
Hail Hydra.
It is Hydra, right? Yeah, gosh.
Well, that's what I found as a new painter. I don't see the mold lines. I mean, I'll see obvious ones, but I don't see it until I'm halfway done with my paint job. I'm like, where the hell did that thing come from?
Yeah.
So one thing,
just the training in your eye for it, you know, over time. But
one thing I would recommend, and this, it can be a bit painstaking, but what I do for some of the more problem miniatures, like a Timberwolf, is after I've scraped all my mold lines and I put it on a base, or if I'm going to just paint it separately from a base and I mount it to its handle, I will dust the miniature, or I will paint it with primer, and then I will dust it from the top down with some white ink or gray paint, and even hit it with a very, very light dry brush. And that really helps to catch any remaining mold lines, and they'll stand out very well. And then from there, you can just gently scrape them or shave them off. And then having that primer layer kind of around it, you're not really dealing with you know, chipping through your paint job, and it's a very thin layer with the primer and the ink over top. So you can kind of sand and file as much as you need around those mold lines that you've just shaved off, hit it with another thin layer of primer or paint, and then carry on with your paint job. Yeah. That's been like a huge one that I've started doing in the last couple of years, especially for kind of the more showy paint jobs where I really don't want to miss any of those and realize halfway through my paint job, I'll do that.
Now, Zach, you're pushing that through an airbrush, right? To like that thin layer of.
Yes. So for those who don't know, I live in the middle of nowhere in Manitoba in Canada. And so in the summertime, it gets up to about 40 degrees Celsius, which is like around 100 degrees Fahrenheit. That's and then in the wintertime, it gets down to below minus 40, which is also minus 40 Fahrenheit. So it's Celsius and Fahrenheit both agree at negative 40. It's just cold as hell. And half the year it's very cold here. So I just don't have the ability to spray paint most of the year, unfortunately. So airbrush has been a huge, huge boon. Airbrush is one of those things a lot of people get very intimidated with. You can kind of step into the airbrush game for a few hundred bucks. And even if you're just using it for priming, base coating, and doing very basic highlighting, it saves a lot of time, a lot of headache, especially if you're dealing with cold or inclement weather, humidity, really, really dry areas, even like Arizona, stuff like that, where, you know, a big complaint with spray paints in not perfect temperatures is like a gritty texture, or you get the paint running off the miniature if it's too humid. With the airbrush, you just don't deal with those issues. So it is an investment up front, but it makes your life so much easier with the little things.
100%. I think like one of our topics we want to talk about was like, you know, what is something that improved your painting? And I think airbrushing, picking up that airbrushing is definitely something. Just to circle back real quick, I think if you are not working with an airbrush at home, I think what Zach was talking about picking up those mold lines, you can also do a quick wash over your miniature. And then you should be able to pretty easily highlight all of those mold lines to catch as well.
Yeah.
But maybe hey, we can Kevin. Jump on to the next topic or it would be. Sorry.
Hey, Kevin, you there?
Yep.
Hey, dude, what airbrush are you using?
I use a Badger Patriot 105, which is an amazing workhorse brush. And like, I've got some different needles and stuff for it, so I can do more fine work with it, but it's insanely durable. In the US, Badger does great customer service for part replacement, and they can't even refurbish it. You have to pay, but if you damage it and it needs refurbished, they can do that. I think I haven't used that service, but I've bought replacement parts, but, it's an insanely durable brush. You can put anything through it. And it's only $100 generally, which like compared to like the, if you're going to get an airbrush, I'm going to get my high horse for a minute. Don't waste your money on the combo kits that you see on Amazon. Like those airbrushes are garbage and you're going to spend like $60 on a brush and $40 on a crap compressor. And like just get save a little extra money, get the Patriot 105. If you're gonna learn, get the Patriot 105 and get a tanked compressor. Like
would you say that a good caveat to that is the Badger Patriot combo that they do for Thanksgiving?
Yeah, if they do that, my initial airbrush was like some not branded like combo non-tanked compressor thing, and that airbrush was garbage. And it clogged all the time and it was hard to maintain and repair. And it was a waste. And like Patriot, the Badger Patriot's a well-made tool and it works really well. And the customer service is great when you have problems and it tanked compressors a must. Otherwise you can airbrush for 10 minutes and then wait 3 hours for your tank to cool off or your compressor to cool off. So, I mean, save a little extra money and you know, there's, it's just super durable. I also use Infinity CR Plus for more fine work. And that's been in the last couple years. And I think that like, my wife got me that as a birthday present a few years ago, and it's been fun to learn and play with. And I can do finer work with that than I can the Badger. But you also can do really fine work with a Badger Patriot 105. Like,
for the money, you think it's better spent on that?
Yeah. I think for sure, if you want to learn airbrushing, especially if you're in the U.S., just get a Badger Patriot.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I'll second what Kevin said, because I had a Badger as my first airbrush, and I didn't switch until just shy of 2 years ago to an Iwata Infinity CR Plus, the same one that Kevin said he's using for the finer work. And yeah, the Badger, I had no problems with it. And yeah, my work 2 years ago looks very similar to the stuff I'm doing now. And it was just with that thing. Yeah. Just the stock needle, just well practiced. It's that airbrush, very good entry level, and it'll last you a really long time.
What do you all think about, first of all, PSI, second of all, dilution, and third, how to clean? Because I think those three things right there are the biggest hurdles to the airbrush that I've heard from multiple people that I've spoken to.
Well, PSI and dilution are kind of the same question, because the more dilute your paint, the lower your PSI can go. The thicker your paint, the more you clog, no matter your PSI, or at least that's been my experience. I know some people are called to 40 and they just set to 40 and they never change it. I usually am around 25.
Same.
For most everything I do.
Yeah, I'm about, same about 20 for me.
And I think part of it is you learn, like you set a PSA and kind of learn from it and kind of get a feel for it. And like, if you learn at 40, you're more comfortable at 40 than you are at 20 or 30. And so some of it's just how you learn it and do it. I learned at a higher PSI and I've been able to dial it back, and dialing it back gives you a little more, for me, it gives me more control. So I can get really fine points with it and not have to mask as much and not get as much like overspray or collateral damage with what I'm doing. Cause I don't do much masking when I airbrush now. Yeah. But so I like the lower PSI range to work with.
Yeah. Same here.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Just to piggyback off what Kevin was saying, like he was mentioning, you know, just adjusting your dilution. Yeah, like I leave mine between 23 and 25 PSI, and whatever paint I'm using, whatever application I'm doing, if I'm doing a base coat, if I'm doing a glaze, I just adjust the paint consistency. I don't really adjust my PSI. I just adjust the paint consistency based on the PSI I'm using.
Yeah. What is your choice of thinner? What are you using to thin your paints?
Standard airbrush thinner for me. I use just Vallejo stuff. I don't know what Kevin uses.
Is that water? Is that spinning water?
Is it? Indiana water.
Nice. Nice.
It's not as good as Spanish water.
Okay. You want to have all those fans.
I've got a source locally, so I'm using Tamiya stuff, acrylic thinner.
Yeah. What about for cleanup? What are you all doing for cleanup?
Guys, clean up.
I see that. Yeah. That's exactly what I use.
Airbrush thinner. I have the same airbrush thinner that Kevin was just holding up. For me, I have it's like an old Windex bottle I just fill with water. And I have like an old, just a Rubbermaid container. I set it on my desk. I'll kind of tip my airbrush upside down at an angle. I use the spray bottle to kind of spray out all the excess paint. Throw a little bit of water in there. I get a bit of backflow, which I'll cover the end of the airbrush with my fingertip, get some airflow, pull the trigger back a few times just to get some backflow. You'll get some bubbling into the airbrush cup. And then what that does is help push some of the paint back out of the tip. And then I just rinse it, take the needle out, clean everything, flush it with water, throw it back together. If I'm doing like a full, like every time I clean it, I just do a full clean. I take the whole thing apart. It's one of those things people get intimidated by, but there's only a few pieces to every standard airbrush. I just find taking it apart and giving it a quick rinse is the best thing to do at all times, or else you'll inevitably get paint drying inside it. And then you'll have to spend more time taking it apart in the middle of a paint job to scrape out chunks.
You know what I love?
Go ahead, Eric.
These guys.
Mm-hmm.
Those tattoo bottles, you know, where they clean your tattoo off with these things. Like, this is great because you can just shove this thing into the cup and squirt it in there and then backflow it, dump it out, do it over again and over again and over again. Like, this is great. I have one of these for water, and then I have another one with isopropyl in it, and it's like, it makes it a lot easier compared to...
Between colors, like full of water, dip the cup in, spray.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't think about that.
Dump it out to quickly change colors and stuff.
Okay. I'm going to have to try that.
But I mean, there's a little bit of fumes to that. Won't kill you.
Probably.
Yeah.
Not yet anyway.
Eric, you said something that's really important though. Zach said it, everyone's afraid of the airbrush, right? Like I've had oh crap moments when I've taken mine apart and been like, oh, I can't put it back together. And there's some videos out there on how to reassemble these things. And like, even on the websites, like you can find an assembly guide and like they go back together. And sometimes like any tool you've used in anything, like sometimes you need to learn how to use that tool the best. You've got to learn how to fix it when you broke it. So then like when you start to have trouble with it, like, oh, I'm getting bubbles in the cup when I'm spraying, where's the obstruction? And if you've floundered around with like taking it apart and putting it back together, like you kind of understand what all the parts do a little better. And don't be afraid of it. Like,
I would say like, if you can assemble miniatures, you can put an airbrush back together. You've got the dexterity to do it. So,
I think people are intimidated because it's an expensive tool. Yeah. And it's like, well, if I take it apart, I'm going to break it. And then like, it'll go back together. Like it'll be fine. Don't be afraid.
And I think every one of us here, have pretty much learned to do 90 to 95% of our hobby stuff just through YouTube. I mean, it's a fantastic resource. And, it's just a lot of trial and error. I've definitely, I've had to buy a new airbrush needle because I accidentally dumped mine on the floor while disassembling it. It's just part of the game. Thankfully, they're consumable parts and they're not expensive. I don't know. It's any tool that you get, definitely take the time and just like get good at using the tool, like, and understand the tool, understand its capabilities. And that's all an airbrush is. It's just another tool.
I'm in a different part of the world, so I haven't been able to use a lot of those YouTube tutorials and, you know, getting the brands and stuff. But what was important for me for buying an airbrush was like, being able to source replacement parts. It's probably the most important thing because, you know, like people are scared of breaking stuff. You will break it. I broke like my first two airbrushes. They were cheap pieces of garbage from the, you know, like talking about later that were came with the compressor, but it helped me learn how the airbrush parts worked, helped me learn how to put it back together and stuff. And so the next brush that I bought, I looked for something local that I could find easy replacement parts for. And then it doesn't matter if you break it because you can just replace it. And they are, you know, the parts themselves are pretty cheap. Like the needles, the nozzles, those are the things that you need to replace. And so if you can find replacement parts for that, then you're set.
As for someone new to the airbrush, how would I tell the difference between I'm making a mistake or something's going on with the airbrush? Like maybe my needle, you know, something got damaged or something like that. Like, how do I know? All right, something's not right here. Is it me? Because for me, I just like my MO is I generally try to, you know, find kind of a really good quality. Like my first airbrush was an Iwata and I had a, you know, tank compressor. And so, because I want to know, if anything sucks, it's my fault and not the equipment. But also there's a lot of times where I'm like, you know, did I bump the needle, you know, while I was cleaning it last time? Is that why it's doing weird? So what are some kind of telltale signs of, you know, it's the equipment versus it's you?
I'd say it's the nozzle being clogged.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that usually comes from paint consistency, right? Like the biggest user control factor is, we talked about PSI, but more like everyone was kind of agreed on like just the consistency of the paint. I think most people will mix it too thick or too thin. And is there like a hack to remember that? No, not really. It's part of muscle memory. You know, you do it enough times and you kind of figure it out. Maybe like a lot of people ask, like in my group, kind of ask like, how do I learn it? I would say maybe the biggest tip is like mix it outside of the cup. People like sometimes mix it in the cup and sometimes, especially it depends on the paint that you work with, but they'll, something like that. It just sinks into the cup. And then if you mix it in the cup of the airbrush, it'll sink into the needle, it'll clog everything up, mix it separately and then pour it in.
Okay.
I am notoriously lazy. So I do frequently mix in my cup, but
yeah,
most times when I get a clog, it's because I have So one thing that's common, I mean, with we've all seen dropper bottles as well as like Citadel paint pots. You get little bits of dry paint on the threads of the bottles, things like that. Nine times out of 10, when I get a clog, that's not due to paint consistency. It's usually because a little piece of dried paint fell off my paint bottle into my airbrush as I was squirting paint into it. So that's another thing to look out for. And that's another thing that, you know, doing what Kevin does, mixing separately, that'll help alleviate those pains. One thing I would suggest too, if you're getting a clog, before fussing around with paint consistency, double check to make sure your compressor's at the correct PSI. I have pets, also have a little kid that likes to run in my office occasionally, and she likes to play with my airbrush compressor nozzle when I usually keep it unplugged because she's turned it on by accident on occasion. But she does like to play with that nozzle, and I've had a few times where I've started painting. I'm like, man, why does this keep clogging? I've thinned this paint so much, it's basically water now. Then I look down, I'm like, oh, I'm at 10 PSI right now. Little things like that. So yeah, my personal first step, if I'm not getting a good flow of paint, I quickly check my PSI. Yeah, PSI is good. All right, now I'm going to check the paint consistency and then do my little troubleshooting. It's usually paint consistency first, take a look at the needle tip, see if I have any dried paint on there, and then I just kind of troubleshoot from there.
Generally, your lighter pigments are going to clog more than your darker pigments.
Mm-hmm.
So the more
white yellows, whites, paint, yeah,
the more likely, because that's how you get dry tip, is usually with like the heavier or the lighter colored pigments. I think generally they're heavier in weight compared to their darker compatriots. And so the more basically white that's in your paint, the more dry tip you get, and then the more clogging you get. So it's usually very helpful for me when I'm using the same color for a long period of time to intermittently backblow, like pinch and backblow back. It remixes the paint in the cup a little bit, and also kind of like anything that's near there. And then I'm not afraid of my needle tip. I pinch it and I pull dry tip off. I wouldn't scrape it on foam. I've seen some people do that. I think that's the way. If it's a fine needle, you could bend it. So if you just, you know, go to the back where your nozzle is and pull, it usually works fine.
Another thing you can do too, if I have a very fine needle, I have two different needles, one that's a very fine needle, one that's just the standard needle for my fine needle. I've accidentally bent it with my fingernail like an ogre. So what I do for my finer needle is I keep a little foam makeup swab, and I'll just dip it in either a little bit of airbrush thinner or cleaner. And I just use that to kind of wipe the end of my needle off, and that'll kind of get any chunks off. So it's very helpful for that. But yeah.
Yeah. I keep a whole bucket of Q-tips just for that, that purpose. Go through
yep.
so quickly.
Those great. Definitely work as well. Yeah. Yeah. Tommy.
Yeah. What's up?
The card game stuff. What got you into that? Cause I love that art style. Like what inspired you to start doing all the minis like that?
I've been playing that card game since like it was a big part of me, my childhood growing up. And so, I'm in Japan, so there's not a lot of BattleTech is not big here. And so it's more about, you know, I can't really establish a community here. And so it was more about painting basically what I liked. I couldn't really play a game. And it just so happened that other people liked it too. And I was really, really happy to see that, to share that with people online. So it was, yeah, it's, I don't know, like I wish there was more connection to Canon sometimes. I want to find out more about like the paint schemes. I'm a huge fan of the Warhawk checkering, for example, if that has a like an official paint scheme or anything like that. People have asked me, oh, is it associated with a particular clan? I'm like, I have no idea. I don't think so. It just looks cool.
Smoke Jaguar.
Yeah. Tommy, you wanted to talk a little bit about painting white, you know, so
yeah,
I'll let you kind of direct that.
I wanted to ask Arclight, actually, people have commented on the beautiful shades of white you've made. I've even heard it referred to as Arclight White on Reddit. Can you talk us through your process through it?
Yeah. So I will be very upfront. I definitely lean on the airbrush, for doing my white, just because, I can do my style of white with a standard brush, but it takes a very long time. It's a lot of glazing. And for those who aren't familiar with what glazing is, it's a technique where you thin your paint down, so you're essentially getting translucent or transparent layers of paint. And that's how it kind of build layers up, so you can get a nice smooth gradient from dark to light. With the airbrush, it's just so much more expedient, so long as you have good brush control. But my primary method is I base all my white in a very dark gray. And if you look at images of my white mechs, like I have an Hatamoto Chi and Fifth Sun Zhang Academy Cotter. And it's like white. It's like a cool white with some blue stripes. If you look and if you pull that image into a color picker tool, like on Photoshop or something, kind of the dominant tones that, you know, dominate that paint scheme are like mid-tone gray. So one mistake a lot of people make when doing white is they actually use too much pure white. Doing that kind of removes your ability to create any real forms of highlight. Like I've seen, you know, and layering up white, especially with a normal paintbrush, takes a very long time to not have a chalky finish. Leaning on those mid-tone grays and then working into kind of an off-white on the highlights really helps to drive up contrast between the shading and the highlights, and then it allows you to really just use the pure white for your very brightest highlights. I like to kind of go with a more zenithal style, and what that means is I like to have my brightest light source kind of coming from directly above. So everything underneath the mech, that Hatamoto Chi in particular, if you take the miniature and you flip it almost upside down, so you're looking at the underside, it's almost a dark charcoal gray. If you look at images, it just looks like normal lighting causing shadow, but it's just all the paint work. So I try to leave as much of the really dark tones still showing underneath. From side on, I go with kind of more of those mid-tone grays, and then from a top down, kind of at a 45 degree angle, I'll hit it with kind of an off-white, and then from very top down, I'll pick out some spot highlights, do a bit of pure white, and then all of the edge highlights are a pure white paint. And then from there, any kind of weathering, things like that. I mean, white's a very, you know, you can tint it with all kinds of different colors. I like going with cool whites just because it looks nice having kind of those blue hues in the shadows, but adding in kind of like warm weathering tones helps to kind of bring in more contrast. So I like doing that as well.
Do you guys have any particular like white paint brands or ink brands that you like to use that have worked out well? Especially you talked about those mid grays, and I noticed like the cool whites that you use, the blues, and it's
open. Yeah, so for me, kind of my general scheme, I use a somber gray from Vallejo as kind of my base color. It's like a very deep blue gray, and then the mid tone is kind of it's a heavy blue gray, also from Vallejo. Then I go into sky gray white gray from Vallejo. All those colors are from Vallejo. And then the pure white that I use is actually a white ink from Dowler and Rowney FW Artist Inks. Not to be confused with Liquitex. Liquitex aren't absolutely awful, but as far as artist inks go, the Dowler and Rowney FW series seems to be pretty good, bang for its buck. I mean, you can get them at most craft stores. But as far as like for pure white and pure black, I use those artist inks, the Dowler and Rowney.
Nice.
Are there particular paint brands that you guys have found just don't work for you, or that you are your go-to brands? Is it kind of like, you know, suit to taste, or is there some brands that are just particularly good for certain things and not good for
everything? I think everything is good in different ways. So I wouldn't say that one is worse than another. I mean, I think a lot of that is user error. So, I mean, and guys can, you know, speak up as well. Like, you know, you just have to understand what is the characteristics of each paint, and then kind of play to their strengths. There are certain, you know, it's kind of like meds, you know, like Kevin and I, like certain medications work better for certain disease states and certain ones don't, like, you know, or depending on the patient, right? Depending on the person or depending on the model.
But they have to actually take them for them to work.
That's a good point. I love I love pro acrylic. I mean, we're going back to just really briefly over to whites. Like, I mean, and you didn't mention, you know, so I don't know how much buying my opinion, you know, if it matters at all. But yeah, I use the same thing. You know, but also like I really like the AK third gen, you know, because they have like silver gray, which is really good. It's kind of like a white, kind of warm, you know, neutral gray. So, and then everyone loves, of course, bold titanium white, right? From Monument Hobbies.
You got to say it, titanium white.
White.
Yes.
So I think depending on what you're using, it really is going to play to certain strengths. Like Pro Acryl, really good. Love it out of an airbrush. I really love AK third gen. I kind of lean towards that and two thin coats. I love two thin coats paints as well. So I think it depends on the person, honestly.
When you use two thin coats, do you say it with a British accent?
I wish. Very important. I wish. I can't get away from this New York accent that I've had since I was like four. even though I've lived down south now for more than my northern life. So, you know, I've been using a little bit of Bear Cavalry paints as well. They tend to be, you know, a little bit more like, I don't know if you could call it oily or like slippery. I don't know how really to describe that. And then Arclight, man, you got me onto the whole like shading in the recesses instead of using an enamel pin wash, because I used to use that and I still do, but using shading, that'd be a good topic of conversation. We're talking about different things playing to different strength.
Yeah.
Awesome. Let's do it.
Yeah. I'll touch on my preferred paints briefly, and then we can go to Kevin and Tommy. I do a big mix. So I have like some Pro Acryl, I have a lot of Vallejo, some Citadel, but I also have a lot of Army Painter paints. Up until probably a year and a half, 2 years ago, over half the paints I had were just Army Painter paints from a Army Painter mega set that I got like 6 years back.
me too.
Yeah. And like, honestly, like a lot of people knock Army Painter paints, and some of the older batches definitely were, you know, kind of wishy-washy, but the last handful of years, they've really come a long way. Some of them are thicker out of the bottle than others, but that's any paint brand. Like Citadel, Vallejo, both suffer the same dramas. There's a few Citadel paints that are notoriously terrible, like Corax White. And a few others, like even Uriel Yellow, which I really enjoy that yellow tone, but it's a pain in the ass to use. It's just it's very chalky and kind of dries out really quickly. I like the AK third gen as well, and I have a couple two thin coats paints as well, one being a pure white actually. What about you there, Tommy?
Hey guys, we're living in a golden age of mini painting, and you guys are truly spoiled for choice. I don't have a lot of choice, unfortunately. I usually use Citadel because basically I use what I can get my hands on. I use a lot of Vallejo. I got the Army Painter mega set as well. I would love to try two thin coats one day. I don't know if it ever makes it over here.
Just tell me, I can send you what you need, Tommy.
I don't want to put too much on you. Also, I'm not sure about like shipping
paint brands for Tommy.
You know, the problem with that is if I enjoy it too much, then it's going to be a huge pain to get replacements, which is mostly why I stopped doing Army Painter, because I can't get them individually here. Mostly I can only get Vallejo and Citadel here in individual pots, so can't replace them. I found myself using a lot of non-miniature branded stuff. Talked about Liquitex really briefly. I do use some of their inks. I only through an airbrush, they don't really work well on a paintbrush. But a lot of their texture pastes, they're meant for canvas painting, but I find it very good for basing materials, for example. As BattleTech painters, I think scale is a big, big consideration. You guys all have great diorama backgrounds. Where do you guys source your scale terrain that is not, you know, the standard 28 millimeter stuff?
I'll go first. I think a lot of us get from very similar venues, but Death Ray Designs, Brigade Models, those are very common ones. Death Ray Designs specifically, like they have a huge lineup of 6mm scale stuff specifically. Same thing with Brigade Models. They have a few different scale lineups, but they have a lot of really good generic stuff. What about yourself there, Kev?
Hardware Studios, Death Ray. Yeah. I would argue I have the worst backdrops in CS.
Not true.
I just don't invest enough time in painting terrain, and because I'm always on like what display model am I painting next, and then like I sneak BattleTech models in between, and I need to probably take like a solid month and just paint a bunch of terrain.
Because I have telling myself the same thing.
I have a bunch of Dale stuff to paint. I just like. I'm a little compulsive, and the print lines bug me. And so, you know, I got an automotive primer and then Mr. Plastic Putty, like in water, and then sand, and then prime and sand. And like I get too hung up and I get them too smooth. So
I feel that pain. There's some I just give up, and I'm just like, nope, it's just it's the future. They 3D print all buildings, and so they have layer lines now. That's just how we're going with, you know. I mean, and in the far future, you know, prefab buildings, boom, there you go. I'm personally a big fan of Brigade Models for like the weird stuff. They have a really good monorail train set that actually goes really well with BattleTech and as far as aesthetic goes. I forgot about Hardware Studio. Dale, one of the CSO guys, he kind of heads up Hardware Studios and really, really cool aesthetic with all of his stuff.
And he sells STLs, so like, yes. If you are international, you can buy STLs online and then print them wherever you can print them.
That's another thing. 3D printing is huge. There's a ton of people in the BattleTech space where that's the majority of the terrain they get. Like Thingiverse and Cults 3D. Raining Fire is one of the users on both those places. And he has a ton of just free, like, urban building STLs. I have a few of those, actually more than a few, that I have printed. He's got some Hextech stuff. That's actually another good one. Thunderhead Studio has their Hextech line. A lot of really good stuff with the hexes and without. So, you know,
Lazy,
depending
Lazy
on your
is awesome. Awesome, like 6mm terrain also, and
yes, very, very highly detailed, like very highly detailed.
Lazy Border stuff is awesome. It's just it's very detailed, so it's almost a display piece on its own.
Yeah, like you could easily sink 30 hours into a building of one of his. Like they're quite immaculate, like quite awesome. I really enjoy them.
Yeah, and I'll throw in Bobby over at Fortress Managers and Games that sponsors this channel. And so a lot of these brands that you guys have mentioned, you can pick up there. So, you know, do a little sponsor shout out and thank you to Bobby, you know, and Fortress Managers and Games for supporting this channel and these podcasts. But yeah, I know the dropship, Tommy, that you're getting in the mail soon is a Hardware Studios, you know, dropship.
Oh, nice.
So, yeah.
Looking forward to it.
Cool stuff.
Yeah. Nice.
Eric, you look like you got some props for us.
I do. So, you can either go through 3D printed stuff, or you can go to the aquarium store and buy a bunch of shale and buy, you know, or go to Home Depot and buy some rocks, right? And then glue them to a bunch of foam.
Oh, nice.
Right? So, like, you get the foam board, like insulation board from Home Depot, right? And you can, you know, super glue or gorilla glue these guys on here, right? And then, you know, take a bunch of glue and a paintbrush, throw some sand on it, throw some rocks on it, right? Let it all dry. Get whatever primer you want. Prime the whole thing in black. And then repaint your rocks and repaint your terrain. You can throw some pigment on. Throw some, you know, just like terrain pieces on. I got these, hence Death Ray Designs. It's a great plug-in. You know, you've got this piece, right? So, and you can do a bunch of these, and this cost me probably, I don't know, $15 maybe. I mean, it wasn't that much money, right? And what's nice is that if you look, for example, I'm working on some Eridani Lighthorse dudes right now. So let me pull this off of, right? You put them on here and, you know, right? You can angle it. You can angle it. Oh no, everything's falling apart. Sorry guys. You know, you can angle it and that's kind of, I kid around when we talk about photo editing. I call it movie magic. When we talk about editing photos, you know, for our CSO website. But, you know, the backdrop doesn't need to be that high when your model is, let's say, you know, 6 millimeters in size, right? So let's just say, because we're talking about it, right? Huge prop. That'll take long, right? Let's just put the box right there, right? You got the box. Photo from 4chan. You don't have to go on 4chan. Don't go on 4chan. Go somewhere else. And go on Google. Free. So, you know, and just, you know, so ta-da, right? You know, get your angle right. Get the grid on your photo, on your camera. And then you got it. You got a new shot. You don't like that one? You know, use another one. Get another photo printed off at Target or at Walmart or whatever, you know, from the Photoshop.
Yeah, I think that'd be like a great topic for, it seems like a much longer sort of conversation. I'd love to see your photo setups because I think a big part of people's, you know, posting online and stuff is they got great miniatures, but you're sabotaging yourself if you're not, you know, taking the steps to take good pictures. It doesn't take a lot of time either.
Well, and you know, you gotta sell the scale, I think. Right? You're talking about models that you gotta sell the illusion of scale at this size. So, you know, you can put different scenes on and you can change the entire look based on, you know, the backdrop and the scene here. I mean, I can do so. The other thing that I like to do is think about how and I know Kevin and I know, you know, we all have done, I guess, 40K at some point, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, you got little circular bases. Well, you can, you know, just make another circular base, but make it a little bit bigger, right? Now all of a sudden you've got a circular base, right? You got some little doodads on this side. Well, you can literally turn that whole thing around 180 degrees and you got an entirely different scene, right? Because the little things are in different places, right? It adds variation. And maybe some people don't notice, but you know, you can change the look based on, you know, based on a circular piece of terrain. So there are a lot of different options that you can do. And I've made like 5 or 6 of these. You just throw it down and you know, to Zach and Kevin's point, you buy 3D printed terrain and just like, you know, pop it on different places, right? Mm-hmm. Turn the base, put them somewhere else, you know, put this little dude here. Maybe I take this thing, I put it there, right? And then maybe I put this and I put it there, right? Or maybe I put it over here. Right, taking different show, you know, so you know, you get creative with it and you experiment with it, you see what works, see what doesn't. You know, if you got a digital camera, you can take 1,000 photos and, you know, you keep a couple of them, right? You don't have to keep all of them, right? You just delete the others because you're not paying for film.
The crop tool is money maker. Like, yeah. It's, I think that's one thing people get hung up on is they try to, I think, especially early on when they're trying to take photos of their minis, they try to get their camera really up close to the miniature in the hopes that they're going to kind of cut out all the chaff and, you know, they want to get the closest view possible. If you're just using, like, I have a $20 smartphone tripod and, almost all of my photos are taken with us, just my smartphone exclusively. Yeah. You know, as long as you get most of the, you know, the miniature and the scene in focus, you can crop everything else out.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then, to touch on, Eric's round diorama base there, I used to do kind of rectangular photo stages, and I still have a few that are rectangular, but seeing Eric with the rounded photo stages kind of got me onto doing those. And one of the things I like about them is one of the issues people have when they start doing photo stages is a lot of people always start with the rectangular ones, but you have that very obvious straight horizon line at the very back of your stage. So then you have to get creative with kind of obstructing that with other scenic bits or your backdrop itself. Having that round photo stage kind of creates that natural, like, soft curve at the yes. back end of your photo frame. So you can just throw a backdrop a few inches behind, and it just looks like a nice, you know, gently rolling knoll going over the yes. horizon kind of behind the mech. So just creating a little illusion. Yeah. Creating little illusions like that. Forced perspective is another fun thing to do. Having something that is either small, you know, small or large, placed in different distances between your stage and your backdrop. Like I have an urban stage. It's like a T intersection with a train in the background. And I like to place Beautiful. A building in between my photo stage and my backdrop. It just helps to add depth, to the overall feel. Yeah, there's a lot of ways you can futz around and get creative.
Futz around and find out.
Futz around and find out.
Perfect. It's here for the jokes, man.
And Zach, I was kind of pushing you, you know, to get into it, to do a lighting tutorial as well. I know on the Discord, you have a lot of information there, but, you know, I think yeah. that would be a great, and just, you know, from what I've seen, things are too general. You know, if you need just someone to be like, buy this thing, put it here, this yeah. distance from that, you know, I think that would be a popular thing.
Yeah, for sure. And it's something I'd like to do kind of a video on in the future, or you know, a collaboration perhaps. I have some good examples, photos of kind of my earlier photo setups, as well as my current one, which is more expensive and a little bit fancier. But my cheap setup versus the one that I have now, there's not a lot of difference in terms of end result. Like for a long time, I was using two $10 selfie lamps as well as my painting lamp. It's just about positioning your lights. I don't want to get too into the weeds and take too much time on that one, but a lot of it just has to do with getting good fill lighting kind of from opposing angles on either side, and then having some good directional lighting to kind of really focus light on certain areas on your stage. Just get everything well lit, and then kind of get that focal point of light over the miniature and kind of the center stage. Those are big ones. Another one people don't really consider is your white balance of your light. Having like a neutral light really goes a long way, as opposed to having cool light or warm light. Though using cool light or warm light, you can kind of create some nice atmospheric effects, but generally speaking, a nice bright, like neutral white light is kind of the best one to go with.
All you need is arc light.
Tell you all about lighting. Yeah, nice. Mm-hmm.
What are some, you know, going back to the painting side from the staging, what are some techniques that you guys have tried and abandoned that you felt kind of were like a false road, and kind of what caused that, and what did you do instead? Is anything that stand out?
Interesting question.
That's a tough one, actually. Abandoned.
Yeah, every technique has its place. Right? Okay. They all have a use.
I would say so, yeah.
Like, yeah. Some, you know, in some get called sexy things, but it's really not anything novel. It's like slap chop. Like, slap chop really isn't all that, like, novel. It's just like you dry brush and then you use contrast paint and, like, and you do it again or whatever. But, like, it sounds cool. So it became like a meme and it was popular. But every technique generally has its place. Like, there's things that I don't like to do. Like, for example, Dale Wonder Gecko, he likes to paint primarily with oils. And, like, he's got, you know, oil basically dry brushing with makeup brushes down. And it's super smooth and looks real nice. I don't enjoy it. I don't find the process fun. and I don't like the limitation in the color pigments with the oils that are available. I could go get like the expensive artist oils, but then you have to thin them down. And I just, you know, the mineral spirits give me headaches. And so like, I don't enjoy oil painting. I use enamels and washes and stuff like that. Sometimes I'm trying to get like quick washing done, on a bunch of stuff, but generally like for terrain, I think oil painting is actually like oil dry brushing is better because I don't have to whip out the airbrush and do all that stuff. And so like, you know, when I am painting terrain, I'll use oils for that. But I think generally I've never abandoned the technique, I guess. Like they all have a spot in the.
Well, I think that's that, you know, kind of evolves the question well in terms of what, you know, what techniques have you found are better for one medium and not another. So you were talking about the oils, you know, for the train versus the miniature and the
dry brushing oils is super nice because it yeah. You know, can get super smooth, and you know, dry time becomes a little bit of a hang up there. And you know, there's hacks for that, like you can aerosol varnish, like to kind of seal in a layer and then just let that aerosol varnish dry for an hour and then go back at it. And that generally works pretty well, but so there's limits to like that, but like you can get super smooth dry brushing effects with oils, which is really kind of cool. I just don't enjoy it, the process. So
yeah, oil paints, just to kind of elaborate on what Kevin's saying there, he mentioned drying times. So depending on how much thinner you add and how much oil paints you're actually utilizing, your miniature might take 1 day, 2 days, 3 days, a week to dry, to where you can actually physically handle it and you're not worried about paint coming off. The benefits there is you have a lot of working time with that paint. And you can actually do things where you let the paint dry for a day or two. So it's not cured, but it is, you know, it's still kind of workable. And then you can add other thinned layers of oil paints on top and they'll blend very well onto the previous layers. But then again, you got to be careful because you can't handle the miniature. So the way you're actually going to handle and paint the miniature while you're physically handling the miniature is going to be much more. You're gonna have to be a lot more ginger and careful about what you're doing, whereas with acrylic paints they dry and cure within minutes, so you can throw on a glove and handle that miniature as much as you want. You're not really going to worry about rubbing that paint off or creating issues. So yeah, like it's they're very, very different mediums in that regard.
I must be a caveman. I never use gloves.
I have sweaty, oily mitts. I have to.
So you're saying you're really blonde. You just happen to paint with red a lot. That it gets everywhere. Sorry.
I don't get the joke. Man.
You didn't never mind. We'll cut that.
It's too late
because you didn't use gloves and paint got everywhere. So like you're really blonde, but now you've got red hair because you like to paint with red. Oh god!
I got it.
That's funny.
Personally, I think that the question, like if you've kind of gone any kind of hobby tool that you see that like someone is saying to you on YouTube that's like gonna change the game. I hate that phrase, by the way, game changer. I hate it. Mm-hmm. By the way, I could cuss right now, but I'm not going to. I hate that so much. To Kevin's point, everything has a purpose. Don't get sucked into, hey, you got to do it this way, because if you don't do it this way, it's not going to be good. That's a little garbage, man. Like you got to find what works really well for you. And then lean on that, right? And get really good at that. And then, you know, you want to try to experiment with something else. Yeah, go ahead. I mean, you know, that's great. Don't fall into that hype where it's like, okay, you know, there's only one way to do a certain thing. Because that's absolutely not true. I mean, we just talked about that. Like we talked about using an airbrush. We talked about, you know, we haven't talked about using certain brushes, but I mean, that'll be a really long conversation, I guess. Talking about dry brushing, right? Talking about slap chop, talking about oil brushes, like don't fall into that trap. Like find what works well for you and then lean on that and what you really, what you enjoy the most, right? Because there could be some styles, like I'm not a big fan of slap chop personally. I use it, but I don't really like it. And you know, I lean more into using my airbrush to do all of the heavy lifting and do all the highlighting for me. I just don't like using it. I love actually underpainting models in certain colors, like what Kevin does with his magenta. You know, I love that undercoat, right? Because you can undercoat green with purple, right? Mm-hmm. And it looks kind of brown once it's done, right? You know, and Kevin could talk about orange, right? Because that's, you know, Kevin's famous for orange. So, and the tricks of the trade on tiger stripes, right? I mean, it's beautiful, right? So it's like, you know, you lean into those styles you like, instead of like, oh man, you watch this YouTube video and you're like, oh, I've been doing it wrong. No, you haven't. Like, you're fine. Like, don't listen to that.
Yeah. Is there a recommended kind of progression of techniques and skills that you guys would recommend along? Like, you know, are there some styles that are better for beginners and some that would benefit from kind of having mastered before you move on to another one?
I think Kevin should speak to this one. Actually, no, go ahead, Tommy. Sorry. I was going to say, Kevin should speak to this one because I think Kevin's probably the most advanced painter here, but.
Mm-hmm. Oh, geez, Zach, thank you.
Tommy, go for it, bud.
Tommy, go ahead.
I was going to say, just keep an open mind, you know, like, I don't think there's a good, like, you know, A, B, C, D sort of progression, whatever, like people would say, whatever it works, whatever you enjoy. You know, if you start with contrast, that's great. That's fine. But you know, the important thing is not to sit there. It's to go on to the next thing. Like, you know, YouTube is great. Don't make it your only technique. Just keep adding to your repertoire. Keep things fresh, but also keep things enjoyable. You know, you're only going to grow as much as you enjoy the hobby. If you find a technique that you like and you want to stick to it, then you get what you put into the hobby. Don't make it a chore. Keep it interesting. Keep it fun.
Like, I'd second that for sure.
What's your objective? I think is that, like, if you're looking to like army paint tabletop stuff, it's great. And like, it doesn't matter. Like, no one has to be me. Like, I always, when I talk about miniature painting, I never want somebody to feel like they have to do things the way I do because I'm crazy. And so, like, in terms of that, I think if you want to do, like, you know, base tabletop models, I think learning how to do good base coats, either with a brush or an airbrush, is great. I think learning how to dry brush well is very important. And there's a really good artist opus tutorial on dry brushing on YouTube that teaches you that the brush doesn't really need to be dry, you know, and so you don't wipe it off on paper towel, use a scratch pad and all that stuff. But
what was that tutorial, Kevin?
What's that?
What was that tutorial?
It is an artist opus dry brushing tutorial about using a scratch pad. And you don't have to use their brushes to do it. It works with makeup brushes. So
that's personally what I use. I just buy like all my dry brushing. I bought like a variety pack for like $15 on Amazon of just different makeup brushes, like different sizes and like bristle types, and like, man, off to the races. You can dry brush almost anything.
Well, like the new hotness on the YouTubes is using like the egg sponge.
Mm-hmm.
Sponge dry brush stuff, and like it's the same basic technique, just with a different applicator. And plus, you know, it's 2026, so dudes buying makeup brushes is perfectly fine. But I think like a really important thing to learn is brush control and like how to manipulate the paint and all that kind of stuff, and how to hold a brush well and how to like position yourself well so that like you have good control. And then kind of go on and like, you know, learn a technique really well. And if you want to learn something else, then learn that one next. But no one, miniature painting is your own journey. And if you want to do like high level stuff, there's a lot of things you need to learn, like how to blend and how lighting and volumetry is probably the most important thing to learn, like how certain shapes show light and how light affects different shapes in different areas, and like warm light, cool light, and contrast, and all those things. Like that kind of conceptual stuff is very important. But then technically, like brush control beats everything else. Like edge highlighting or blending or whatever. Like, it all comes down to like how to use the brush bristles to achieve your effect. And all that comes down to is how you handle the brush and brush control. And so like those kind of things, like, you know, are you comfortable in the position in? Are you ergonomically okay when you're painting? Or are you like hunched over doing, like, I mean, it's like you need to be in a comfortable, you're going to sit somewhere for 4 hours and paint a picture. You need to be comfortable. Like, you don't want to have your neck hurt. And so like learning all that stuff is kind of foundational to being able to do this kind of stuff, like for fun. Like, you don't want to feel like crap after you paint miniatures for 4 hours. Like, you want to feel like you did something cool. And so like good seat, good position, all that kind of stuff, I think, is important. I could talk about that for hours. But
to piggyback on two things that Kevin said there. So first being brush control, there's one thing that it's a common thing I see in a lot of Facebook groups or Reddits, Discords, people who are new to painting. A common complaint, like, man, this takes so long. I'm constantly making mistakes. It's frustrating. And I see a lot of, and it's well-intended advice, but what I see from a lot of people is, don't worry about the mistakes, just go back and clean them up later. In one way, yes. But in another way, I would say that's not the most productive way to learn how to paint. What I would suggest is, especially early on your first couple of miniatures, if you're a brand new painter, you've never done it, or you've only painted a few, really focus on being as accurate as possible, and as stable as possible. And we'll get into stable painting position in a minute, but early on, building good habits is going to pay dividends in the long run. Yes, you're going to be slower in the beginning, if you're really focusing on trying to be as accurate as possible and not making mistakes. You're still going to make mistakes. It's going to happen. But the
one second, guys, I'll be right back.
No worries. But the intentional focus on trying not to make those mistakes is going to build good painting habits. And then eventually you're going to be much quicker at painting accurately than you would have been painting inaccurately and then going back and touching up later. When it comes to positioning and stability, everyone has their own preferred method that's comfortable for them. Some people like to put their forearms on their desk and put their wrists together. I tend to do that quite a bit, but I put my elbows on top of my desk. I have like a good chair that I have at my office desk. It's like an AK Racing gaming chair. It's got good support. I can sit in this thing for hours. Now, obviously, if you're new to the hobby, investing in an expensive chair just on the whim of like, I might like this painting thing, probably not a good idea. But if you're somebody who, you know, gaming is one of your other hobbies, you probably have a decent chair already as it is. If you don't, invest in one. I say this as a current serving military member who has all kinds of back and hip issues. So a good chair goes a long way. For me personally, I like to have my elbows on my desktop because then my arms are nice and stable. I bring my hands together in the middle, so my hands are together. It just makes everything as stable as possible. I have a small tremor in my hand. I have to kind of brace things as much as possible to keep myself from shaking, especially when I'm trying to paint straight lines. The other thing that comes down to is having like a good painting handle. That's something that a lot of people don't touch on early on, but I mean, you can go, you know, like low cost with like a wine cork and a bit of sticky tack, sticking your miniature to the top of that and using that as a painting handle, or you can invest in something that's a little bit more robust, has some more options. Like Eric has, I can't remember what brand it is, but it's a painting handle with kind of like a little screw cap. You can mount it to that. It's got the little arch there, so you can kind of brace your hands or fingers against, depending on like what part of the miniature that you're painting. I am constantly rotating the miniature in my hand, turning it upside down, the handle upside down to get at certain things. So having a painting handle that affords you some extra stability and options definitely goes a long way. It'll save you some pains.
I can chip in on maybe the other side of the equation, the low cost side of the equation. I don't have any of that stuff. I paint on my couch, and I have a table that has little legs on it that I put on my couch. It keeps me comfortable, but maybe the handle I think is great to touch on. I'm definitely on the low side, the low cost side of things. What I did was I went to the supermarket. And I touched all the bottles, the plastic bottles, and found one that really fit in my hand really well. And I like having a plastic bottle because it's long, so I can brace it against myself. Usually, I brace against myself like this because I don't have a desk that I put my elbows on. I kind of space is kind of at a premium here, so everything's collapsible. And so it's just a bottle that I and then I get bottle caps that I just screw onto the bottle, put some plastic, put some sticky tack on it. Super cost effective, and it's endlessly customizable because you just go find a ball that you like that fits in your hand. And I get a good angles on it too, because if I want to paint something upside down, usually I brace it against my shoulder or something like that, and I find it helps me with the brush control without breaking the bank.
That's actually really ingenious.
Yeah,
I
it
never
is.
honestly
It's
would have
really
I never
good.
would have thought about
It's because I can't get those fancy paint handles here, so.
Well, they don't make paint handles at custom width, so you might have found the better solution there.
We really do need to make Tommy like a care package of like used
Yeah.
supplies.
Yes.
Oh, man, I just want like Gundam miniatures back.
Yeah, that's
Yeah.
you know what? No problem. I can get anything for you on that end. No problem. Let's see, you got the
Touched on one thing though. It's like I have like a nice basement like painting studio thing. It's been great. But like painting time, like as my kids get older and stuff, just diminishes. And I paint upstairs in either the kitchen or my living room, just so I could be around my family. Because I might have a half hour to paint a day when all said
Exactly the same way.
and done. And
Yeah.
like I just want to be around my wife and kids. And so my wife hates it because I've got like a bunch of hobby crap upstairs now, and I have to like on Sundays make sure I pick it all up. To stay married, and I'm kidding, but it's nice. So like I have this nice studio I airbrush down here, and like if I have the house to myself, I'll come down here and paint for a bit. But like I'm often upstairs painting on the couch, which isn't the most comfortable, but like it helps me like kind of watch TV and be around my wife and not hide while I'm doing my hobby. And so I've had to learn that side of things too, and it works. It's doable. It's nice to have a nice studio to come down to. It's really cluttered. I need to clean it up, but it's also perfectly doable to paint on your couch.
Yeah, I've got a little collapsible table that goes right on your lap. It's got like a it's for like TV dinners, but it's got like a little cup holder, so I just put my cup of water in there, and then it's off to
I
the
don't even do
races.
that. I just paint on the ottoman.
Well,
My wet
you're
palette.
pro.
I'm painting the ottomans while hunched over.
Think my wife would kill me if I did that, but
Let's talk about
I
my
wear
basement
gloves,
a
so I
little
don't know, you know.
bit.
So
Oh, the glove
not a
wear.
barbarian.
I do everything in the garage. So I kind of set aside space, but my prior life, I guess you could say, working on cars, like I feel most at home here in the garage and on a separate high workbench. I bought a packing table from Uline that's like really high. So for me, I keep the chair pretty low, and I'm like literally like right, it's like right in front of my face with my elbows up like this, where my elbows are like, I'm not hunched over, I'm like, almost
Sitting
vertical.
up straight.
Basically,
Yeah, I think
And
that's super
that's
important, right?
exactly
Like,
how I do it as well.
yeah.
If you're
So
hunched over, it kills your neck, so.
it does. It does. I also I do a lot of work without magnification, and I think it's worth touching because I don't think any of us have talked about this yet. But I also do a lot of work under magnification too.
Interesting.
I've got a 10 times magnifying lens with a halo light around it that I use for like really close up stuff if I'm having a hard time seeing what I want to see. And your mileage may vary. I love it. I'm used to using it. It takes a little while to get used to you know, putting your model with your painting handle, you know, behind that magnifying lens that's lit up. But you don't have to use it. It's just something for me that I enjoy using if I'm doing stuff that's like really, really up close work that I really want to see. It does help a little bit with the mold lines too. So I'm using that, and then I keep a bag. I don't keep it in my truck or anything like that, but like if I'm going over to my parents' house or something like that, you know, I'll bring a bag with me with a couple of things. And I know I've taken it with me to talk to other people about painting D&D related miniatures as well. You know, you go bring a bag of stuff with you and go paint with them too. And it doesn't have to be, the point I'm making is it doesn't have to be like a solitary hobby, right? Like you can actually go out and actually do some of this stuff with other people too, you know, over at your hobby shop or, you know, over at your friend's house or whatnot. So it's been really good. Whatever works for you.
Kevin, you picked up a set of magnifying glasses recently, didn't you?
Yeah, I've been painting with Mark One Eyeball for this whole time and just started playing with magnifiers recently.
Working on, how do you like it so far?
I mean, it's really nice. I can see how unsmooth a lot of things are. So like I'm working on some stuff for Adepticon that isn't Battletech related, and it's really helpful to have that because I can see better where the brush is hitting the miniature, and like for painting faces and that kind of thing, it's been really nice. It's also nice to take them off and just kind of do some like, and I think like, I'm sure judges and competition have magnifiers on and looking at your pieces and stuff. So like, it, you know, it's helpful to kind of see, oh, that spot's not perfectly blended. I need to go back and fix that. Mm-hmm. But also then like, I think, you know, you lose the forest for the trees a little bit. So you have to kind of like take them off and be like, I have not yet painted a Battletech miniature with a magnifier. So everything I painted for Battletech is all Mark One Eyeball. And it'd be nice maybe, I don't know, I can't show pictures of the Akuma I did for other reasons, but like there's a lot of freehand on that Akuma I did recently that may show up in something at some point later. And that trying that with magnifiers might have been better because it was very headache inducing doing it with just my eyes. But at the same time, like it looks good on camera. And so maybe I could get it better.
Speaking of headache, I'm just curious, have you experienced any like eye strain using the magnifiers at all?
Not yet.
No? Okay. Yeah.
I mean, I had them on, I worked on Thor for like 5 hours yesterday and I had them on.
No issues.
No, okay. I had them all the time. It's fine.
Interesting. All right. Yeah, because that's one thing I definitely find. Like I have astigmatism and nearsightedness in one of my eyes, and I definitely find like I don't use magnifiers or anything, but even just Mark One Eyeball, if I'm painting for more than an hour or two, I definitely have to take like 5-10 minutes away from my desk to like let my eyes adjust to something far away, or else I start getting like a bit of a headache. I think that's probably just a personal thing for me, but yeah.
It's a good habit to keep in general.
Yeah.
We were talking about something earlier about the basing materials and the scalable materials. And Tommy, we had a conversation that was interesting. We were talking about basing. I'd like to get into basing a little bit, but to kind of start it out, we were talking a little about materials and scale and how, because Battletech is so small, trying to get basing materials that fit right. You know, can you share a little bit of kind of what you were sharing with me and kind of what worked? We were talking about snow specifically. What you found worked better.
Let me get up from my desk. I'll be right back.
Okay.
But someone else could.
I can talk a little bit about small basing things. You can keep basing simple, or you can make it pretty dynamic. I'm kind of notorious for overcrowding my bases with details. I really find when it comes to kind of earth ground texture at scale and Battletech, you really want something that's very fine. Like if you're going to use sand or like a basing texture paste, you really want something that's fairly fine. I see a lot of newer people use kind of like grittier, like cork bits and things like that, which when used in conjunction with some finer textures, definitely works well. But yeah, trying to keep scale in mind. Like if you're using kind of grittier stuff, you got to keep it in perspective. Like this isn't a guy walking on gravel. This you now basically have a robot walking on a bunch of giant rocks. If you're thinking about things in scale. But Tommy, you're back. Let's see what you're talking.
Yeah, you man, I don't have that much stuff, but yeah, I was talking to Travis about like how a lot of the traditionally marketed miniature stuff doesn't really work because it's geared towards more of a 28 millimeter scale, which I think ArcLight, Zach, I think you're probably touching upon. But I end up using a lot of like just art supplies, like the Liquitex is one thing. I talked about how you use it for it's for canvas, it's for like building texture on canvas, but like a lot of like their pastes, like paper paste, the coarse pumice gels I use for just for rocks. The snow is actually just this paper paste. This is like this white, kind of like a pulpy sort of material that I just spread onto the bases. It doesn't even need paint on it afterwards. Travis and I were experimenting a lot because like the Citadel snow and like a lot of the scenic snows don't really work at the Battletech scale at all. And so I found this to be really nice. I've hand sculpt a lot of my bases with just like air. This is clean, a Ziploc bag. This isn't really... scan, well, I guess it was this air dry clay that I just slop right onto the bases. You can make a lot of texture by hand through that, and so you have a lot of control over it. So.
Yeah, one thing I'm a big fan of is using like very fine texture paste like that. Another thing that works well is like any kind of like two-part epoxy putty, like Milliput, something like that. One thing that is very handy is if you put it on, you apply it smooth, you can use just your finger with a little bit of water to smooth it out like nice and smooth if you want like a very like fine sandy base. Or another thing that works really well to add kind of natural texture is using a paste like that, let it firm up a little bit, and then taking tin foil, scrunching it up into like a very tight ball, and you just kind of gently tap all over with the tin foil. And what it does is create like very randomized texture within the Milliput or whatever epoxy you've used. It looks really, really nice and very natural because it's all kind of random texture.
Really cool. Sand. I didn't think about that. I'll have to try that.
For sand, I've done Milliput and like sculpted out the basic shapes and then let it set for an hour or two before it fully cured, and then took like pretty fine grit sandpaper, like 800 to 1200. And just flipped the sandpaper over and like pushed it down on the Milliput to kind of get sandy.
Yeah. Very similar. Yeah.
Worked real well.
Eric, what do you got for us?
So I use ballast fine buff, you know, from train sets.
Oh, nice. Yeah.
Right. So, and then some coarser stuff. And what I do is like I'll use either Elmer's glue or you can use Mod Podge from the craft store and just, you know, douse your model bases on it and then dredge it like in a container. Like I know a lot of guys do that. You could also use, you know, Procryl. They make some nice basing. Actually, Bear Cavalry Paints makes a nice basing texture as well that I haven't gotten my hands on yet, but I need to. I'm trying to think of what else is really good. UV resin is really, really good for water as well as gel. I know Kevin does some great stuff with water bases with the UV resin.
Actually, so, not UV resin.
Is it not
it's
UV?
Just a, it's just a two-part? Or
what is it? Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Cool. Okay.
Okay. Interesting.
It's just classic air dry. Nice.
Well,
okay.
I guess it's not entirely true. So I use a little bit of UV resin, but that's just to seal the barrier.
Okay.
To not get leaking. Now, it doesn't work on bigger water bases because you can see the line between the UV resin and the two-part epoxy. The UV resins, like when you do a deep water pour with them over time, they yellow. And so, like, you know, for like a like those big like game or Golden Demon like water bases, if you see, like, they're probably not great to do like UV resin for it. But on like, it's really hard to get a good seal on a hex base, like with an acrylic barrier. And so I put UV resin on like a toothpick and I draw a line a few times with that UV resin and the toothpick around like where the base on the inside meets the barrier. And then I'll cure that and then I'll pour my epoxy in. Epoxy, the deep, the shallower, the smaller the pour, the longer it takes to cure. And so, and I could talk through the whole process if you guys want, but
yeah. I'm personally very interested because I've never done the water bases and you have some really, really, really nice examples.
Yeah. Tommy and I were actually just thinking about doing a TCG one where Mascara is in a
rapid cool down.
Trying to get a clear resin pour.
First tip is don't do it on an MDF base. The Sagittaire I did was on an MDF base, and like the downside to that is like the bottom of that base is peeling away. And so like do not do any kind of water pour on an MDF hex base. So it's gotta be plastic or acrylic or metal. But you measure out, the acrylic I use is just like the acrylic on these like blister package things. So it's not fancy acrylic. You measure out sections and you gotta be really accurate. And I actually try not to make like six small sections. I just have one long one and then just score it. So it kind of bends around the base. And so it fits around. So like the sea foxes I did for Gen Con that I gave away. Yes, I did give those away. I did that on acrylic bases. And so get your barrier set, hot glue on the bottom and around the sides to kind of seal that acrylic barrier onto your base. And then UV resin just kind of where the base on the inside meets the barrier, so that angle, and let that cure. And then mix your two-part epoxy up. And then use a syringe to kind of drip it or get it into the mech base without getting it all over the mech. And then wait a week because those shallow pores, for it to fully cure, you're looking at least probably 3, 4, 5 days. So after that, peel the hot glue off that's dried, peel the acrylic barrier off. You're going to have a meniscus. And so then shave that meniscus as flat as I can. And then I'll take I think it's AK Interactive, like water gel, and kind of fill in there to kind of fill that meniscus back up. And you really can't see that division at all. I guess back up one. Before that, you've got to sand it all down. So, 200 grit to 3000 grit, sand all with water, so wet sand that whole thing until it's polished. And you really don't want to sand after you've added stuff to the top, because then it'll get in there and get messy. So sand all your sides smooth so that it's flush with your base and you don't have anything that's like jutting out. Fill in the meniscus with some kind of clear gel that dries in a few hours. And then the texture part, I use like the cotton from Q-tips and UV resin, and I'll kind of put UV resin on a paper plate and tweezers and kind of swirl little bits of cotton in there, and then I'll make waves with that. And then to kind of get like on the Savage Wolf, there's like a wave that's really coming off the foot. And so I'll like, as the light's on the UV resin, I'm like pulling simultaneously to kind of like make it cure like as a long stringy thing. And then so all the waves that I want, all the ripples I want, I'll do that. And then more water texture with, I think, AK water ripples is another one. And that's it. To get the sides that you can see into the base super clear, I'll paint gauzy agent, which is something from the modeling world where like on like the clear canopies and stuff, to kind of get those to shine real well, they'll paint that on canopies and stuff. And that's basically the process start to finish.
Was it gauzing agent? Was that?
G-A-U-Z-Y, gauzy agent.
Gauzy agent.
It's like an orange and white tub.
So it's almost like a super gloss coat of sorts.
It's very fine, and it's kind of meant to make those clear canopies. Like sometimes when you mask or work around those with paint, they'll get like a little frosting on them. It kind of defrosts it. So after, when I've got those edges as smooth as I can get them, then there. And like, I'm really like, not that great at water pours. There's like better water pours out there, so it's something I'm still learning on. But it's really hard to do it on a hex. Like, it's insanely hard to do it on a hex because
you got those sloped hexes, right? Like, I was
right. So it, especially if you're trying to do it on a tournament legal hex, that was even harder to do. But good learning opportunity, fun to do. I hope those miniatures are being enjoyed by their owners.
Would a circle be the best shape for that, or
it depends. I mean, like a circle would also be hard. Like the easiest resin pours are when like only a piece of the base, like one facing of the base has it. So like when you see display plinths that are like square and like it's cut away and there's water on like the front, like then you only need a barrier on like the front part. Like, you know, the less opportunities for a leak, because like a leak is catastrophic. It's a mess to deal with. Like you won't catch it initially. You'll go to bed, you'll wake up the next day and there'll be clear resin like that poured out from your leak all over the place. And, you know, your plinth is kind of ruined because you have to sand all that resin off. And it's the more sides, the more facings, the harder to do. So like if it's a round base and the whole base is water, I mean, you got to have a really tight sealed circle.
That barrier on the inside is a good tip though. Definitely give that a try with the UV resin.
It's really nice. It shows up too much on bigger pieces. So on BattleTech minis, when things are so small, it kind of
problem, right?
To hide it. And like, you know, if you're doing like a resin pour that's like that deep, it's going to show up and it'll be pretty obvious. And then like the miniature painting is all about like creating a reality in a piece. And anytime you break that reality, it makes it hard to submerge yourself in that. And so if you see something that obviously breaks that reality, like a mold line, for example, you can't get back into it.
The immersions.
Breaking from the basing, we only got a couple questions though. If you guys have questions for each other, I definitely want you to kind of chime in before we sign off. But do you guys have some like favorite tools, you know, and kind of that you've gotten that just, you know, you use every time that you feel like need a little shout out that people may not realize how useful they could be?
Something. I'll be right back.
Absolutely.
It's a tough one.
Yeah, Eric, when we're talking about mold lines, you showed us a little scraper. You know, are there more little, you know, fun things like
yeah,
that?
Yeah, I have at least four. So, I'll go grab at least.
For me, it's the brass brush. Honestly, like the brass, but for the plastic minis in particular, the brass brush is. I know Eric hates that term game changer, but it made my life infinitely easier. It pared down.
It was in my original question, but I dropped it out for his sake.
that brass brush, it really pared down a lot of time on prep work for miniatures. Like I'm working through a few different box sets prep work right now, like the BattleTech Aces set, and like I can get through a miniature like fully cleaned in a little bit under an hour. It's still a big time investment to hit all the mold lines, or at least most of them, kind of that 90% solution. But the brass brush, that's probably my biggest, like it's a $2 brass brush, and it makes my life so much easier. I would also say actually silicone sculpting tools. You can get them for fairly cheap. And like I use masking putty when I'm doing camouflage paint schemes. And the silicone sculpting tools are really good to kind of push that masking putty into all the little recesses. So that's a huge one for me as well. And it's really, the sculpting tools are great for, you know, if you're filling gaps with green stuff or just some other kind of epoxy, or if you're trying to, you know, create little designs in your terrain, little indents, stuff like that. They're really handy.
You know, that's something I might have to actually hit you. I was actually just looking at silicone putty, but I can't get that here. So I might have to, I was thinking about asking Travis for some, but you know, what I can get here that maybe you don't have is, I have this, I love these, these are a really, really thin brush.
that I've been able to find in Japan, but it's an iCraft series that I recommend to anyone who comes here. It's basically the super, it doesn't really, you can't really see it very well. Super thin brush. It's also very long, so it's got a very long body. It's great for edge highlighting. Basically, it's basically almost built for BattleTech scale because it fits right along the edges. It's how I get my grids, like the all my checkering I do with this brush. Generally, I'll take like a size zero brush and basically dot everything, so it's not a checker. But then I go up and down with this very, very thin brush. It's great for BattleTech scale. I bought like a pack of five. These are pretty expensive. They're all like Glinsky brushes, but they last me a long time. So it's like a small independent company that makes these here. Be happy to send them over in exchange for silicon putty.
100%. 100%.
Eric, did you grab something for us?
I did. I grabbed a whole bunch of stuff. So yeah, I know, right? There we go. Okay. So this is the magnifier I was talking about. Okay. I use this almost every day. You can judge me all you want. I don't care. I almost every day use this. This is Mr. Super Clear Varnish. You can definitely get this in Japan. I use that to basically seal all of my models, whether it be acrylic or sometimes I use oil brushes over there. I exclusively use 1500 Mr. Servicer, Mr. Finishing Servicer for my priming. Love that stuff. Justin from Death Ray Designs really sold me on this. I use this almost all the time for blending. Josanja Magic Mix. It's really good for blending color for acrylic. I use Gamsol.
Gamsol.
Almost all the time, right? Because I use pin wash for a lot of stuff, right? Silly putty, I feel like, is a must have if you're masking anything. It works just as well as any of the more expensive stuff. I use either a makeup or a good cup that has some texture so you can wash your paintbrushes with. You know, the Iwate Eclipse, I use this as my workhorse for all my basing as well as priming, whether it be acrylic and primer or enamel primer or lacquer primer. I have a Badger 105. I now use the Affinity. I use a good pair of tweezers because you always need those for stuff. I'm just giving you an example. It's my Aristope is really U0. Sable brush. I love that brush. I use this thing all the time for almost anything. So it's really beat up. Two other things. I almost always have a wet palette. Because I'm almost always using the wet palette. I don't really use paint out of the pot. I always like to keep it, you know, blended on the palette. And then something that I absolutely use all the time that I think people forget about is a paint mixer. So I have a Lab Genius. This is really used for test tube samples in a lab to vortex those samples, whether it be, I don't know, plasma or blood or whatever they're doing. It's great for mixing paint because you just throw it on here and, you know, mixes it up. So those are kind of my go-to. Oh, of course, a light. I mean, I think, you know, that's kind of a given. So those are kind of my go-tos. So use those every day.
I actually have one more thing I wanted to mention. So this has to do with... So... This is from a Krydroofy. It's like a paint set thing, but it's just a double water pot. I like it. It's got little brush holders on the side, so when I want my brushes to dry, I hang them upside down. But the reason why I swear by a double water pot is I do what I call a dirty rinse and then a clean rinse. So I have, you know, both sides are filled with water. I have my dirty rinse, which is my initial rinse, and then I do a second rinse in like my very clean water. Okay. For me, that's huge. If I'm like working on metallics in conjunction with other paint colors, it helps me avoid getting like metallic flakes mixed in with my clean water. Because if I'm going to add some water to my paint to thin it down, I use the clean water from the clean side. It's also good if I'm going from like a very highly saturated color, like red or orange or something like that, and then I'm going to be painting with white, it also helps to avoid me contaminating my white with dirty water. So it's just a very small thing, but I find it makes my life a lot easier. I used to just use like 2 cups, but once I got that thing, everything else that came with that thing sucks, but that double water pot with the brush holders are absolutely money. So
the brush holder seems like a good feature. Yeah.
Yeah. Being able to hang your brushes upside down, if you can get like an upside down brush hanger, it's really nice, especially like with the artist inks that I use, they like to wick up into the ferrule pretty frequently. So I'm constantly rinsing my brushes, and I don't like things drying up in the ferrule. Ends up splitting the brush so you don't get a nice sharp point. So absolutely huge.
What about you, Kevin?
Just give me number 3 Sable.
Yeah.
I mean, I do 90 some, most of my work with the number 3, like, you know, the tip's all that matters, and it's got a nice big barrel on it, and, you know, keeps paint moist, and I love me a good number 3 Sable, good brush soap to clean it with, good wet palette. I'm happy.
Yeah. Masters brush cleaner is kind of what I go with for brush soap. There's also Winsor & Newton has a really good like heavy duty brush cleaner. If you have like paint dry up in the ferrule of your brush, or you just have like dried chunks of paint in your brush, that Winsor & Newton stuff will break it down very, very easily. And that's the one.
Be careful. This will eat plastic.
Yes.
It'll eat plastic. So if you put it in a plastic cup, it'll eat through that plastic cup.
It'll also eat some of the glue from that binds the ferrule to your wooden handle. Right. So when you dip, if I use that stuff, I have like a little glass jar, and I take a little bit of sticky tack on the inside of the rim, and then if I want to soak my brush, I will just dip the very just the bristles and the very tip of the ferrule in, and I'll stick it against the side. That way it doesn't go up the sides of the brush, because I have had painful experiences with that.
Don't run this through an airbrush. Hear me say it.
don't run it through an airbrush.
Your airbrush uses plastic and rubber seals that are very small and very challenging to replace, and this will eat those. So, I know your airbrush looks metal, but it has plastic and rubber parts. So hear me say it very clearly. Do not put this through an airbrush.
Well, I haven't used my airbrush in 2 years, but that looks familiar. Yeah, and I would say if you happen to have run it through an airbrush, what do you do? Is it gone? All right.
If it's fresh, like if you just did it, just rinse it with a ton of water.
Yeah, flush it with water. Yeah.
I mean, it's probably fine, but like, I didn't realize that stuff ate plastic, and it ate through a cup when I was trying to because I had a clogged nozzle I couldn't get clean. It's like, oh, I'll soak my nozzle. So I took the airbrush apart and I put the nozzle in a little plastic cup with that stuff, and it cleaned the nozzle great. Like, and the nozzle does not have any plastic parts, but it got the nozzle declogged for me. But then it ate through my cup in a matter of like 2 hours. So that was messy. So
good tips.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to piggyback on one thing Kevin mentioned, he mentioned like a good number 3 Sable. So for me, my workhorse is a number 2 Sable, and I do like all my detail work I do with a number 2, or for the very, very small fiddly bits, a number 1. But I personally never go below a size 1 brush. And 90% of the work that I do detail wise is with the number 2. And it just comes down to a really good fine tip on your brush. Goes a really long way, even for the smallest of details. And Kevin mentioned the number 3 has a nice brush belly, holds a lot of paint, a lot of moisture. Same thing with the number 2. It's just a little bit smaller, but it's having a brush that holds a decent amount of moisture and paint prevents you from having to go back and forth between your palette, your water, and your miniature as frequently. There's, you know, a lot of people swear by, you know, their size zeros, double zeros, and they do great work. But I personally have found that I go between my water, my paint, and my miniature a lot more frequently if I'm using a smaller brush, whereas the number two and number one, I just keep slapping paint on the brush and keep her going.
Well, that goes back to like that brush control comment, right? Like you learn the tool you like the most. Like I'm using a lot of Monty and Hobbyers brushes right now because I got a Monty and Hobbyers gift card, and so I'm burning through that. Their brushes are decent, like, and they're made here in the U.S. or at least they're not made in the U.S. but they're sold in the U.S. so it's easy to get them. I mean, the Camara brushes are great. Winsor Newtons are great. Raphael's are great. Like, there's a bunch of great different sable brushes out there. I'm just using Monuments right now because I can get Monuments for free because I got a gift card. So when I burn through all those, I'll go on to something else.
All right, Jeff.
You have a pretty big...
Sorry, go ahead, Zach.
I was just going to say, I have a pretty big mix of brushes myself. Yeah. And honestly, like, I've never personally found that one brand is like specifically better than the other. Mm. Like, I've used Abtang, Winsor & Newton, Rosemary & Co. I have a few like Ammo by MIG brushes, and I don't really notice a big difference between them. As long as they're a good quality brand, you're probably going to get a good quality product.
Nice. And he's taken care of, and they do eventually.
Yes.
They do eventually, even with great care, they do eventually kind of like wear out and you got to replace them. But
sounds good. Well, let's wrap up. Do you guys got any questions, last minute questions for each other before we sign off?
When do you want to do this again?
Yeah.
Seriously.
Well, let's, I'll put it kind of in the pinned comment for YouTube, but I definitely encourage people to kind of hop down in the comments if you have questions for these guys or anybody out there. Put it in the comment and we can make it for a discussion. I'd love to kind of do more of these and, you know, kind of mix and match some of these artists with others and maybe sit down and focus on more some targeted skills with these individuals. So if you guys make your questions known in the comments, we'll know kind of where the demand is and what we can do to kind of help you guys elevate your game. But I really appreciate you guys taking the time and kind of sharing your craft. It's been fun.
Thanks for having us, Travis.
Thank you for having us. I learned a lot. Thank you.
My pleasure, guys.
Yeah, pleasure to meet you for the first time there, Tommy.
Yes.
Yeah, and me as and everyone else as well.
Yes.
Get to put a face to names, yeah.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah, and for the audience out there, you can expect some more Renegade HPG this year. So I'm trying to come at the babies we've been making humans and raising humans lately, but I think we've kind of found a rhythm. So hopefully we can.
I feel that.
We've added two to the family since my last podcast with Lauren, I think it was. So, but we're finding our rhythm. We're at three. Maybe we'll get four or five, but not yet. So we got a little break. We'll do some more podcasting this year and kind of, but make yourself known in the comments. And thanks again, guys. And have a great evening or morning for Tommy. Over in Japan.
Yes. Time for lunch for me.
Nice.
Awesome. All right.
All right. Cheers, guys. Fellas. See you, Tommy. Thank you.
Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks.